Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Lessons with Leaders, a special edition of Lehigh Valley Discourse. I am your host, Lori Siebert. Our producer tonight is Neil Heaver. This is Lessons with Leaders, a show where we have the opportunity to understand what makes the Lehigh Valley great and the leaders and people who get us there. We want to understand what drives them, lessons they would like to share, and why they call the Lehigh Valley home. My guest this evening is Dr. Jacqueline Fetrow, president of Albright College in Reading, Pennsylvania, since June 2017. She's an accomplished higher education administrator, widely published biochemist, and award-winning teacher. Dr. Fetrow came to Albright College from the University of Richmond, where she served as provost and vice president for academic affairs. She also held a faculty appointment as professor of chemistry. Prior to this, she served in a number of roles at Wake Forest and the University of Albany. She had served for 4 years as chief scientific officer and director of Geneformatics, a biotechnology software company which she co-founded. As part of its executive management team, Dr. Fetrow played a key role in developing company strategy, raising more than $50 million in 3 funding rounds and building the 65-person organization. Dr. Fetrow earned a doctorate in biological chemistry from Pennsylvania State University in 1986 and a Bachelor of Science in biochemistry from Albright College in 1982. She has published more than 80 peer-reviewed or invited articles and is listed as an inventor on 5 U.S. patents. Her work has been supported by the National Institutes of Health, the National Science Foundation, and the American Chemical Society. A native of Camp Hill, Dr. Fetrow is the recipient of several awards and honors, including teaching awards, as well as Albright's Distinguished Alumni Award and Young Alumni Achievement Award. Her mother, Millie Folk Fetrow, was a 1958 graduate of the college. Welcome to the show, Jackie.
I'm so pleased to be here, Lori.
Thank you for traversing to Bethlehem from Reading. I want to just first introduce you to the audience because I was so impressed when I first saw you. And how that happened was I attended a Lehigh Valley business event called 90 Ideas in 90 Minutes. And I was so impressed with your talk, I just had to have you on the show. If you recall, I ran up to you after the presentation. And so I thought I would like to start with something you said. And I think it's perfect because you are an educator. I love educators. I have a lot of educators in my family. And you said, learn to learn. It's the key to success. So can you talk about that and what led you to that statement before we get to know you a little bit more?
Thank you, Lori. I'm really honored to be here today. And for being interested in what I said in 90 Ideas in 90 Minutes, I thought that was a really fun and interesting event, and I learned a lot from all of the speakers. As an educator, I am very interested in learning and how students learn and what they learn. And your question, why do I say learning to learn is the key to life, is a really, really good one. My college education, as you already mentioned, was at Albright College, the place that I now serve as president. And Albright College is a liberal arts college. And most of my faculty appointments have been at liberal arts colleges. And today that term, liberal arts, it has not a great connotation in many quarters. And we hear so much about, well, you're a philosophy major. What are you going to do with that? You're an art history major. How are you going to get a job with that? And such responses actually ignore the facts. So the biggest major represented in the high-tech CEOs and the high-tech firms is philosophy. Liberal arts college graduates are way overrepresented in the Fortune 500 CEOs, in the Philanthropy 400 leaders, as well as even in U.S. senators. And even the New York Fed has published and says that the return on investment for degrees, they've divided it out by major, and it doesn't matter. You get a 14 to 18% return on investment, whether you're a history major, an English major, or a business major. Almost all the majors are in that 14% return on investment range. And that leads me to ask the question, why? What is it that places like Albright College do that helps people to be successful. Albright College is nationally ranked for their graduates moving up one or two socioeconomic quintiles within 15 years after graduation. That's a fact that we're very proud of. So what is it that we do so well? And to me, that answer is that we help, you know what liberal arts colleges say? We help students to learn about critical thinking and evaluating evidence and communicating well. But I want to take a step back and think about what is it that really allows these folks to reinvent themselves each time a new opportunity comes along. And it's really about, there was kind of an aha moment for me. I read a book, the author of Investing, The Last Liberal Art. He talks about creating a network of models. And what the liberal arts help you to do is create a network of models so you can approach a problem from the math point of view or the history point of view or the English point of view or the cultural and arts point of view. And because you've looked at the question or the problem from multiple directions, you are more likely to come up with the best answer, not the first answer, but the best answer you can. So really what we're doing here is helping students to learn, helping them to look at unsolved problems, being able to take a step back and say, how do I look at that question, even if I don't, if I'm not an expert in the field? And I would say this is a thing that is crucial for today's college students. Projections show, you probably think about, okay, how many jobs have you and I had, right? Maybe six, seven, eight, mm-hmm. That's what they projected. They're projecting today's college graduates will have somewhere between 25 Ooh. And 30 jobs. And you might say, well, that means the students will just move up within a company. That's kind of what we think. But in fact, not. In fact, what the data say is that these kids will have up to 20, 25 jobs in five different industries. And it gets even more interesting. Why is learning to learn so important? Because, in fact, the Bureau of Labor Statistics says that 65% of the jobs that our students will hold, the students who are in college right now will hold, have not been invented yet. And it gets even more scary because a more recent study said that 80% of the jobs that will exist in 2025 have not been invented yet. So if we focus narrowly on teaching students skills, and we do, they need to get that first job. That's critically important. But if we only teach them the skills for that first job, we are not preparing them for a lifetime of careers and jobs that haven't been invented. We have to help our students be ready for that opportunity that we yet can't predict, but they need to be ready to say, I can look at that opportunity, I can solve that problem. That's why I say learning to learn is a key to life.
That's wonderful. And I can tell you're so passionate about it too.
I am.
Which is what, you know, intrigued me actually about your talking too. And it's so important as you lead the college. Love that. So I think it is important to kind of reiterate that learning to learn will help us get through even those positions that haven't been invented yet, because we won't be opposed to that change and the unknown, because we've been raised with that, especially in a liberal arts environment, mm-hmm. of kind of learning how to face those challenges and unknowns that we have.
That I think that's absolutely right. I mean, you look at me. I was a biochemistry major, a science major. That's part of the liberal arts. And I was a chief scientific officer. I started a company, so I was a business person, raised money. And now I'm a higher ed administrator. I'm not working right now as a biochemist because I was willing and able to take advantage of that opportunity. I bet you have stories like that, too.
Yeah. It's wonderful. Well, let's go to our Albright College for a moment and maybe how some of this might have started you on your path, because I saw in your bio that your mother went to Albright College. You went there, you're now there, and leading it, which is wonderful. So let's take you back. What were you like in college, and did you know what you wanted?
Well, that's a great question. By the time I got to college, the answer is I did know what I was pretty sure I knew what I wanted. I was a nerdy science kid. I've been a nerdy science kid most of my life. When I was in junior high and high school, I thought I wanted to be an astronaut, actually. That I thought being an astronaut would be super cool. But in those days, you sort of had to, like, be a pilot, be in the military. It was not as open as it is today. I love the sciences. I love asking questions. I love trying to figure out how things work. I want to make a side note here, a little pitch for young women out there who might want to be astronauts. There are huge opportunities. Check out the Brooks Owens Fellowship, which encourages young women from every different pathway into the astronaut and aerospace careers. But anyway, my desire to be an astronaut morphed into being a scientist and a science nerd. I spent a lot of time in the science building. I did, and one of the great things about Albright College, you have the opportunity to do research directly with faculty. We have that today with our ACRE program, the Albright College Research Experience. And I had that way back when I was in college. I did research with Professor Frieda Texter. I studied, this is going to sound bizarre, I studied the enzyme kinetics of a protein called pyruvate dehydrogenase. And you think, what is that? And what does that mean? But that set me on a lifetime of really being curious about how proteins work, how proteins in our bodies affect our health and our aging. And that's what I've studied all my life. And that was what my company was built on, understanding the function of proteins.
So how did your mother influence you to go to Albright? If she did at all, maybe it was your individual decision.
My mom was really great. She did not make any push towards Albright College. And at the same time, I knew she loved Albright College. She was a very active alum. She would host alumni events. She would host at the house new student events. In fact, when I was a kid, I remember painting a very large sign with the Albright Lion. Our mascot is the Lions. And I painted our Albright mascot on a very big sign that we put in front of the house to let students and the alums know this was our house and this is where the picnic was. So she was always really engaged with Albright, and her Albright education served her very well. She was an accomplished and award-winning public school teacher. But she never pushed me to go there, but I was always just aware of the college. And So really it was just making college available, and I just knew a lot. I applied to a number of colleges, but Albright College was the right place for me.
Well, I think it's wonderful that when you're growing up in a home, too, of education, that kind of goes back to mm-hmm. that loving learn to learn, and how you probably lived it every day, experiencing her as a public school teacher, mm-hmm. and obviously a wonderful one if she won awards for it. So growing up, you had that influence as well for education. That could be why maybe your career has...
Sorry about that. Can you do a pickup? I thought I had my volume down. I'm going to ask you to
That's
do a
okay.
pickup, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Sorry about that.
Let me make sure my volume is down. It's a good idea.
Yeah, me too, actually, Neil.
No, I could have sworn okay.
I didn't do mine either.
We're all checking.
I went there and I hit the master volume and knocked it down. All right. So I'm sorry. Can you pick
That's
up
okay.
Where you're at, anytime you're ready.
It's great that your mom was a public school teacher, so that you kind of lived that growing up with it. And what other influences did you have in the family? So you were fortunate your mother had gone to college, mm-hmm. so that's already puts, you know, children ahead when their parents have had that education as well. She was a public school teacher. Tell me, what else was your family life like? Were you an only child, one of many?
It's a great question. I had a great family. I've already shared about my mom. My dad, David Fetro, he was a truck salesman. He was a real estate salesman and ultimately became an office manager. He worked with my brother in his business. The my parents were always, they always encouraged us to explore, to push our limits, to never set an artificial boundary. You know, my dad would push us in sports. I remember playing football with him when I was a kid. Well, you know, kid, I loved football. My mom would say, you know, you want to cook dinner? That means you don't have to do the dishes. And she would let us explore and do our own thing, even to the point she'd give us the money to go shopping. So my parents always encouraged us to push our limits. My sister, I have a brother and a sister. I'm the oldest, and probably they would say that I'm bossy. But my brother and sister, we've always supported each other. My brother, Brad Fetro, he owns Fetro Electric in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, one of the big electrical contracting firms, started that business. He worked with my dad in that business. And my sister, she's kind of been a serial entrepreneur. She has started several companies or picked up early stage companies and ultimately sold them to multinational firms. So my brother and sister are very accomplished entrepreneurs, and we have always supported each other's success. So I'm very lucky in my family situation.
Well, I think it's interesting, your background, and as listeners listen to your story, they probably relate to certain things you say. And as the interviewer here, I'm sitting here relating to everything you're saying as well, because I grew up in a home where my mother would have loved to have been an educator and my father was a salesman. So I'm kind of laughing in my head as you're telling these stories, because the salesman part of your father helps you be probably the personality that you are today, the little bit of extroverted, a little bit of maybe, you know, kind of selling what you have to do when you go into business, whether you're going into business or leading the college as a leader. You have to be able to have that pitch that you're kind of talking with people and sharing with people. And of course, back to, again, your mother saying, you know, learning is so important. So your brother and sister, and you were the oldest, so we often see that with leaders. What influence do you think you were to your siblings? Did you feel like you had to be a role model for them at all?
No, I think Brad and Steph would say I was bossy.
Okay.
I think mostly just that we've supported each other. We continue to support each other. We get together. Sadly, both my parents have passed, but we continue to get together for holidays and occasional dinners. We're very lucky with our family. I don't know that I set a role model. I would say my brother and sister are as much role models for me as I am for them. My brother Brad started his company when he was in his early 20s, and it's been an ongoing and very fine, you know, electrical contracting business since then. So I think we're setting examples for each other.
Well, I think it's interesting, too, and we're going to talk about this after our next break, about your entrepreneurial experience with starting your own business. But I think it's interesting that each of you have had that entrepreneurial spirit. You don't often always find that in a family where there's three of them. You might have the oldest child who has that, but not necessarily, you know, each of the children. One last thing, you had said that your mother was very involved as an alumni with Albright College. So mm-hmm. Did she stay in the area as well?
She did. My father grew up in the Harrisburg area. My mom grew up in the Philly area, and we all went to the Harrisburg area. We were in Camp Hill, so central Pennsylvania broadly defined, not the Lehigh Valley, but the Cumberland Valley.
Okay. All right. Well, when we come back from our next break, I want to talk to you a little bit about your own business, and we will continue our discussion with Dr. Jackie Fetro from Albright College, president of Albright College, and we are listening to Lessons with Leaders. We will be back in just a moment.
Spread the word about your business or organization to a well-informed audience. Become an underwriter with WDIY. Our lineup of NPR news and locally produced programs reaches thousands of engaged listeners in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Underwriting on WDIY is an affordable and effective way to provide information about your product and services to people who care. To learn more about underwriting opportunities, 610-694-8100, extension 6, or WDIY.org.
WDIY 88.1 offers many choices and real voices. Folk music, from folk classics to the Gaelic traditions of the British Isles, to bluegrass and old-time music of Appalachia, to the modern-day singer-songwriters telling the story of today's world. You'll find it all here on WDIY. Listen and enjoy the wide variety of folk music every weekday evening, 7 to 9 p.m., just after NPR News headlines, and Sunday mornings at 11 a.m. on 88.1 WDIY and streaming at WDIY.org.
Welcome back. You are listening to Lessons with Leaders. I'm your host, Lori Siebert, and I'm speaking this evening with Dr. Jacqueline Fetro, president of Albright College in Reading, Pennsylvania. And we're talking about her various roles in leadership and learning a little bit more about Jackie and her background and all of the things she's done. Jackie, you had mentioned your family seemed to have a very entrepreneurial spirit that could have been driven by, I believe, probably your father's salesman, part of his personality, which I think is fabulous and wonderful. And I really admire people who are risk takers enough to go and start their own businesses. Now, we know from the introduction that you have had many roles in academia, but you also had your own business at one point. And in your 90 Ideas in 90 Minutes talk, you said to believe in your mission and work to make it believable. I loved that. So believe in your mission and work to make it believable. And it sounds like you did that for your own business. So I know you're in academia now, but let's take you back to running your own business. Let's go back in that world for a moment and talk to me about that.
I am happy to. I loved the world of business. And, you know, when Geneformatics ended, I thought I would stay in business. As you say, I give my dad a ton of credit. He was entrepreneurial. He started a few businesses. And I think that's probably where my sister, my brother, and I get our entrepreneurial spirit. Talking about mission of a business, and the mission of a business is, I think, really important. I already talked about my interest in proteins and how we look at proteins to understand human health and human illness, and how we use proteins to develop and design drugs that are specific for the symptoms or the diseases that they're addressing, but not causing side effects. That's a big problem in the biotech industry. And way back when, in the heady days of sequencing the human genome, we had some technology that was getting the interest of investors, and we formed Geneformatics. And I was a co-founder with my partner, my fellow scientist, Jeff Skolnick. And we rolled out, and we raised 3 rounds of venture capital, and we had a terrific time. The mission was important because it was really about how do we use those genome sequences and the proteins that are encoded in the genome sequences to impact human health, to understand the functions of the proteins better so we could understand and use that information to support for pharmaceutical and biotech companies, mm-hmm. to better impact human disease and illness. And that's what we did. That was our mission. We were using software and databases to support the ultimately impacting positively human health. So aligning the mission with the business was a crucial thing, even when I was in business. The mission of positively impacting humans.
So you could have believed it, and your partner could have believed it, but then you also had to go raise money, and you had to make your investors believe it as well. So you actually had to bridge probably the scientific understanding of it to the delivery in common language that your investors could understand. So I imagine you had to kind of, really concentrate on how you were going to raise money for this mission that you knew and believed mm-hmm. in and could see it at the microscopic level, or as you said, using, computer software. Mm-hmm. So what was that like going out there? How did you feel? You had to really bare your soul, I suppose.
Yeah. It was a really, really fun experience. So I recognize that I'm a scientist. I'm not a business person. So we hired a CEO, an experienced CEO, an experienced CFO, John Schmidt and John Chiplin. And the three of us would go out together. And in doing the pitch, that partnership, that collaboration was what really made it work. Because they could talk about the finances and the business model. And then my educator genes would come out, and my ability to help the teaching part of it, to help the potential investors to see the link between what our technology did and the impact it could have on ultimately human health. But these were venture capitalists; they're interested in their return on investment. Right. Where would it impact the dollars?
So I'm in my mind. I'm kind of going through when we talk about lessons with leaders. So often I think people make assumptions about leaders and leadership roles and how they get there and how they got there and what made them successful. Really, can you give us a little example of what leadership skills you needed at that time? Because in my mind, I'm saying you had to recognize that you needed help on the business side, mm-hmm. but the leadership skills said to you, I have this business idea, mm-hmm. this is valued, mm-hmm. valuable, valid, and I can move forward with it. But it didn't mean you had to do it all by yourself, I guess is where I'm getting.
Right. And I think that's a really insightful question, Laurie. And it's insightful because I think one of the crucial pieces of leadership skill, and it comes back to the learning to learn. Learning to learn is recognizing when you see a big problem, recognizing where you know it and where you can provide insight, and recognizing where you don't. So at this company, so I'm a scientist, and people think, well, scientists, you should know about software and databases. But in fact, that's a different, you know, obviously business and finance are a different skill set. But the engineering and the databases are also a different skill set. So in the scientific team I put together, I didn't just hire bioinformaticists and computational biologists. We had a team of database administrators and software engineers, and I will say, led by my sister, Steph. Mm-hmm. We worked together at the time, and because she's a software engineer, or that's where she started. And so recognizing the different skills that are needed, that I don't have them all, that I had to bring in that expertise, and that I had to facilitate or help provide the environment for them to be able not just to work together, but to effectively communicate with each other. And there's a really fun example here. And again, this is in the 90s. You know, we hired some people who had very focused degrees in bioinformatics. It's the skill-based training. And I thought, these people would be great. They'll know about the science and they'll know about the computer science and the computer engineering. But they really didn't. They were unable. They knew very shallow amounts across, but they were unable to actually have the effective deep conversations. And it was really folks who had a more in-depth, almost the learning to learn, liberal arts education, that were much more able to have the effective conversations across those disciplines and be able to move our company forward. So providing that and bringing in the right people who could effectively communicate across the disciplines, recognize the differences, and then provide the work environment where they could thrive was crucial.
So many examples of leadership skills that are needed at all levels as well, you know, even when you're bringing that group together. Fascinating. Now, you did move past the business and back to academia. So tell me about that journey. What brought you back?
That's a really interesting story because at the time, I said I was never going back to academia. I loved the startup world. I loved the raising money world. It was a very fast-paced, moving environment. And I said, I'm not going back to academia. And I have to say partly that was because my first faculty appointment was at a big state school, which looking back now was not a good fit for me. It's the liberal arts college that's the best fit for me. But I didn't know that at the time. I'm like, I love business. I'm going to stay in business. I had the great good fortune after we merged the business with another company to be able to take a little bit of time off. So my partner and I sold our house, put all our belongings in storage, bought a travel trailer, and we drove around the country. And I was able to spend some time thinking. And during that journey, a person, a great mentor and advisor was my thesis advisor, George Rose, who is retired from currently Johns Hopkins University. And he called me up and he said, they're looking for this faculty position and endowed chair at Wake Forest, and it sounds just like you, Jackie. Do you want me to nominate you? And I said, heck no, George. In fact, I used a worse word than that. But I said, no, George, I'm going to stay in business. Academics is not for me. And he said, Jackie, you're at the beginning of your job exploration. This is great advice. You should explore all your options. I'm going to nominate you anyway. And I said, okay, George, do whatever you want. And I continued on my journey. Well, the way that it ended up was I ended up at Wake Forest. And the reason for that is an interesting story. Because of the first interview, they invited me for an interview. And I landed in the Greensboro Airport, and I went to their conference center, the Grayland Conference Center. It was raining and ugly, and I'd never been to Winston-Salem, North Carolina before. And the faculty members picked me up for dinner. And I thought we would go to a restaurant. We would do what faculty members do. We would talk about our research, because that's what we do. We didn't. We talked the entire evening about teaching. This was a group of physics faculty members, and they talked the entire evening about how they were using technology to help non-physics majors understand and learn physics. And I'm like, wow, if we can spend a whole dinner talking about using technology to improve the education of our students, especially for the non-majors, this might be a school that I should be really interested in. And it turned out it was. I spent 11 years of my life and career there. It was a great, great opportunity for me. And it was because what tugged at me when I interviewed there was the teaching part, how committed the Liberal Arts College of Wake Forest was to the education of the student.
The confluence of events that led to that is so interesting to me, because as you're telling that story with the physics professors talking to you about teaching non-physics majors how to learn more about physics, to me almost mirrors some of that story you were talking about with your business, that you had to bring together professionals who were working to help your business that didn't always understand all the parts of it either. So it kind of springboarded off that. George, who had done that referral, did you have a nice call with him to tell him thank you very much?
And I did.
George, I guess you knew.
I have told him. I have laughed at him and said, George, you know me better than I know myself. George has been one of those. I've had, besides my parents and my brother and my sister, a couple of very special people in my life. Frieda Texter, my advisor at Albright College, and George Rose, my advisor for my thesis work, and a few others in my life. I've been very honored. And I've gone back and I said, George, you know me better than I know myself. And during my inauguration at Albright College, he came and did the introduction for me. And I was really honored that he did that.
You know, I want to go back too with Lessons with Leaders and talking about that. Sometimes even as leaders, we don't always have all the answers or know the exact direction that we may be going. Sometimes people think it's all about the focus and knowing what you want to do from the time you're a child. It can evolve over time.
It can and it should. To me, the well-lived life is where your vocation and your avocation are merged, where what you love is what you're doing. And that can change. It might not be the same as in the 20s as it is in your 30s, as it is in your 40s. And allowing that to change, be open to the opportunity that there might be a new passion you identify or something to explore. That's what a well-lived life is about. And helping students to be open to those opportunities, to just not be focused on the narrow path, it is what I love to do. And I've seen the students who have done research with me take circuitous pathways, and they'll call me up and like, I'm leaving science, are you going to be mad? And I'm like, no, if this is your passion, follow it. And they've had some very interesting life experiences.
And they don't always know where it might lead them or take them back to.
Exactly.
As well. Now, you've had increasing roles of responsibility through your career as faculty and in administrative roles, but you also seem to continue to research and write, which I was, wow, you're still researching and writing. So how do you keep that balance, and how has that helped you in what you do today?
Oh, I like that question a lot. I love research. There's a piece of exploring the unanswered questions, of discovering new information and new knowledge, and then thinking about how to apply that to a way that could positively impact something in a small way, has always compelled me. And I honestly like the process of writing. When I have the time to sit down and write, work on a manuscript, the discipline of telling the story of a research project with, you know, writing an introduction, why should you be interested in this, describing the results in a way that the reader can fully follow the story, and then in the discussion and conclusions, really explaining the impact and the next questions. That's a discipline that I really enjoy. I don't have enough time to do it, but I really enjoy it. And so I have always, weirdly, wanted to continue to do research, and I've also wanted to continue to teach, and I've been able to do both. I have students who do research with me, so when I moved into the dean role at Wake Forest, I kept my research lab open, and I had grad and undergrad students working with me. When I moved to the University of Richmond, I had a small research group that was undergraduates working with me to look at the beauties of proteins. And even here at Albright College, I actually still have a student at Richmond, Michaela Rosen, she's a junior. She'll be graduating in another year. She's working on writing a manuscript with me. And a student, Sarah Hostler, at Albright College, who's just beginning her project. Now, they're much smaller than they were when in my big researcher days. Mm-hmm. We're not going to have this big of impact. Watching the students be able to go from just spitting out the facts to being able to really think about the question more broadly and say, okay, well, maybe, you know, Jackie doesn't know the answer to this question. How can we figure it out together? Because that's how I try to push them. It's really fun. Yeah.
Do you find yourself wandering the halls of the science buildings at Albright College?
I would love to be able to do that more. I actually did during January, and I saw one of the faculty members sitting in there, and she was working at the NMR spectrometer, and I thought, oh, it would be fun to go in there and see what kind of experiment she's doing, but I didn't do that.
That's funny, and you know so many big words. when we're going to get ready for another little break, Jackie, and when we come back, I want to talk to you a little bit about your landing as president of Albright College. Folks, you are listening to Lessons with Leaders this evening. I'm your host, Lori Siebert, and we have Dr. Jacqueline Fetro from Albright College. She is the president of Albright College, and we're talking about lessons with leaders. We'll be back in just a moment.
Not only is becoming a WDIY member a great way to support the programs you love, it has its benefits. WDIY members have access to our weekly member ticket giveaway emails, discover great concerts, theater performances, film screenings, and more, all while supporting the many choices and real voices on WDIY. Make your gift today at 610-694-8100 extension 7 or wdiy.org. Thank you.
Welcome back to Lessons with Leaders. This is your host, Lori Siebert. I am speaking with Dr. Jacqueline Fetro, president of Albright College in Reading, Pennsylvania. And she is my guest here at Lessons with Leaders. And we're learning more about her and her journey from college student at Albright College to business person, to academic, to very many paths that she has taken in her life. Jackie, we were just talking about your research and writing and how you love to do that. And I think that goes hand in hand with, you know, everything that you've been talking about, you know, learning to learn and being open in education, etc. This has all brought you back to academia, as we discussed, and now back to Albright College, your alma mater, but as president of the college. We were just talking how you landed at Wake Forest and you were there for 11 years, and I know you had some some other positions in this time period. But how did this happen? How did you come back to Albright College? What was that like?
It was very serendipitous, completely serendipitous. The job of getting a college presidency is you're actively recruited for it. And I was being recruited for several presidencies. And a recruiter who knows me very well, and I was not finding the place that was the right alignment of my passions. Sort of like I described to you already, the alignment I felt with Wake Forest. I wasn't finding that right alignment. And of course, that alignment is crucial if you're going to be the president. And a recruiter who knows me very well, she called me up and she said, I'm going to send you a prospectus and I think you need to read it. And she said, and don't stop when you see the name. And so she did, and I did, and I read it, and I'm like, oh, this is interesting. And so I put it on like my bedstand, my nightstand. And the next night I read it again, and this went on for a couple weeks. And finally one night my partner said, he said, Jackie, are you going to do something about that? And I should say my partner, Brian Cowell, he's very insightful, very wonderful life partner. And he said, are you going to do something about that? Or is it just going to sit on your nightstand? You keep coming back to it. And so then that's when I jumped into the search and went through the whole process. Coming home was very interesting because there's always that trepidation. Is the college what you remembered it? Because we all remember our undergraduate college right. days, this kind of cool time, right? And so the question
is,
in the lab, or, you know, the other fun things that we did. And the question is it still the same place? And it's not going to be. It's what, 30, 35, however many years later. And so when I did my listening and learning conversation, I was listening to hear, what is Albright like today? And lots of things have changed. The people have changed. Buildings have changed. But what I learned is that the heart and soul of Albright College, that love of students, that support of their success that is essential to the kind of education we provide has not changed. Our faculty and our staff are still there to support the success of the students. And that was the alignment that I felt when I read the search prospectus. And when I came back, it really still is there. And that is what makes this a great job for me.
Wow. And it was just coincidental that it happened to be your alma mater.
It was just coincidental. Yes.
Now, can I ask, was your mother and father still alive when you came back?
They sadly were not. Oh, they sadly were not.
Okay. No. Maybe they were guiding from
my. Yep, that's right. There you go.
You are a leader. In your 90 Ideas talk, you said, people matter. Language matters. Diversity matters as well, as many other brilliant observations, because I took a lot of notes during your talk. What leadership skills do you rely on the most in navigating the future of the college, which includes helping those students navigate their future as well, I imagine?
Yeah. It's an important question. I think there's three. I think the most important skill is listening and actually hearing what the other person is saying, not what you think they're saying, but what they are actually saying and feeling. So I already mentioned when I started at Albright College, I was very aware that I could not assume this was the college that where I was a student. And so I initiated a listening and learning conversations. Mm. And I met with so many people. I think when my chief of staff added it up, it was somewhere like 700 or 800 people, students, faculty, staff, and people in the Reading area, as well as small groups of alumni, in small groups, really listening to what they wanted to tell me. What did they love about Albright College? Where did they see it going in the future? What were the challenges they thought it was facing? And that ability to really hear people's perception of Albright and their aspirations for Albright's future has allowed me to really pave this deep, what we're calling the deep dive emergent strategic planning process, where we're building towards our future. So listening is first. The second is asking questions. Because the first answer people give you is not always the answer, right? And they'll give you the surface. And what you have to avoid in asking questions is to ask, you don't want to put your own bias into it. You don't want to ask the leading question. You need to ask the curious question. And what else? Tell me more. What do you think about that? Without putting any of your own thinking into it. And gathering that information, being able to remain curious helps a leader to make the best decisions. I think bad decisions are made when you have it's like the network of models we talked about. When you have a very narrow point of view, you come at it from one direction, either your own or somebody on your leadership team. If you listen more broadly, you can actually build that network of models and come up with a better decision. And then the third, so listening, remaining curious, asking questions. And then the third is the transparency and engagement with the community. It's not about where I think Albright should go. Albright and institutions like Albright, we're centuries old. Albright's 150 some years old. We are going to be here well beyond my lifetime. So it's not about my vision of 5 or 8 years hence. It's what does the community see of itself, and what does the community aspire to be, so that we are all building a shared vision together and pulling all in tandem towards that future. So really listening, remaining curious, and then transparency and engaging the community in really considering its future. I think those are the most important leadership skills, if I was to name them, that I rely on.
These are great, and great takeaways from this show right here. I'm taking notes and writing fast and furious as you're talking. I think this is brilliant. I love it. Listening and hearing, curious questions, and the transparency and engagement with the community. Now, I want to go to something you had said at the 90-minute talk. Mm-hmm. You had said you were trying to avoid the advice monster. Now, when we think about leaders, again, sometimes we think people, you know, they just have that vision, they know what they want, and you just want to do what they're doing and maybe even be told what to do by the leaders. Based on what you just said, it doesn't seem mm-hmm. to be that at all. It's not that the leader is actually pushing their ideas mm-hmm. as much as gleaning the best ideas mm-hmm. through this kind of process, mm-hmm. which is great. Mm-hmm. So that advice monster, which you, I believe, admitted that you have.
I have an advice monster.
I also have it because I have a weekly radio show where I give advice. So it's very difficult to resist that. So you recognize that at some point and switched to this.
Yeah, and I was the smart aleck kid. I was the smart aleck teenager. I was the smart aleck 20-year-old. I thought I knew. I was a know-it-all and knew everything, and that is what I did. And that made me not always very popular. As I became a leader, I've mentioned really great mentors and coaches in my life, and I've been very fortunate to have a few. And I had one at Wake Forest, a woman, and she's still my friend, Rebecca Thomas. Her daughter's coming to Albright College, and I'm excited about that. She came into my office one day, and she said, "Do you realize the impact you're having in that room?" She said, "There's just a few words you need to change." And that embarked on a conversation about how my language as an ambitious female scientist was negatively impacting the ability of a room to move forward. And her advice and her ongoing friendship has enabled me to really move beyond, because it's that second one. It's the asking curiosity questions, because usually what I would do is I'd ask a question, but it'd be a leading question. Well, have you ever thought about Jackie's idea, right? That's the leading question. You want to avoid that entirely. And Rebecca and several other great coaches and mentors have really helped me to think about how to step back, how to breathe, be aware of my response enough to know, okay, this is my response, but let's remain curious to see what comes of this.
I love it. It's really having a presence. Yeah. You know, you have to be very aware of where you are.
And I think one of the things I will tell you, one of the things that came out of that, I'll give you an example in my listening and learning conversations. I did have a sort of I was thinking about college and pricing and affordability a lot. And there's this in the colleges I have been at, the high price, high discount model. And in listening and learning conversations and being able to actually hear and ask questions, I learned that we had for a while at Albright been moving down the wrong path, moving tuition way high and moving out of the market of Albright's a college that educates students of academic promise, and that's America's middle class. That's where I came from. That's where so many of our alums came from. And what they were seeing was we were moving way out of that, and that was not feeling good to people. My ability to hear that and then to the community worked together. One of the deep dive teams worked on what's going to be our pricing strategy that aligns with our mission of educating these students of academic promise. And in December, we announced a tuition right-sizing so specifically that we would be more accessible and affordable to a much broader swath of college-age students who will find the Albright education so valuable.
And tuition right-sizing. Mm-hmm. And in leadership, it's sometimes taking chances because you don't always know what direction this might take.
Right, right.
But you get the people around you. You had a team that worked on it. So, and that all came from your listening. And
it came from the listening and learning and the asking questions. And then the team, as I talked about transparency and engagement, a team that worked asking questions about this model for 9 months, and we reviewed about 9 different pricing strategies in higher education, evaluated, this team did, how each one could be applied to Albright, what would work for us, what wouldn't, applied our data to each model, and this was the recommendation they came forward with.
And will that get launched?
This fall, it's already out. It's up on our website. Okay. Colleges can learn too, and we learned. And to align with our mission, tuition right sizing was the way we needed. That was important for us to go.
Yeah, you could live anywhere. You chose to take the position at Albright. Maybe the location might have factored into your decision to live here. Not sure. How do you like this area?
I love Pennsylvania. I grew up here. Okay. To me, all the places I've lived, and I've lived in Albany, New York, and Rochester, New York, and Boston, and San Diego, and Winston-Salem, North Carolina, and Richmond, Virginia. And there was never any place like Pennsylvania. The beauty of central Pennsylvania, our mountains, our Piedmont areas, and our valleys, coming back to Pennsylvania was really like coming home to me. My life partner, Brian, he's heard me say, we'll be driving somewhere, you know, we'll be driving through the mountains of Pennsylvania. There's no place like that beauty. And in fact, the first summer I was home, I was listening to the radio, and a local orchard was announcing, the Lodi and the transparent apples are in. It's time to begin apple season. And the thought that immediately popped into my head was, it's time to make and freeze the applesauce. Because when the Lodi and transparent apples came in, my mom and I would always go get the apples and we would make the applesauce. And it felt like I hadn't heard about Lodi and transparent apples for 30 years. And so it was really, really like coming home.
Wonderful. Now, Reading is a little bit west of what we might deem the Lehigh Valley on the westernmost front. How do you feel that Albright College and Reading, do you feel like you are part of the Lehigh Valley? What is your reach for the college?
Absolutely. Our reach for the college is definitely very strong into the Lehigh Valley. We have a very large number of alums living in the Lehigh Valley. This is a big recruitment area for us. All of southeastern central Pennsylvania and definitely the Lehigh Valley, and some really great alums who I've been talking to, doctors. We are very strong in the pre-health programs, majors, And we have a large number of doctors and those in the health professions here in the Lehigh Valley. So just love the Lehigh Valley.
Now, when you have friends over, do you put a big sign in the front yard where you've painted the lion so that when they come?
My days of painting the Albright Lion mascot are over. I never had much talent. I just didn't know it when I was a kid.
So this is a good move for you.
This was a great move for
You're happy.
Yeah.
You had mentioned when we were on break that with your student in Virginia, you were doing some online, you know, you're able to Skype or do online chats, et cetera. Does Albright College have any online programs that
we
they do?
We do. We are dedicated to education, both of traditional aged college students, that's our residential college, and the post-traditional student who that would be in our School of Professional Studies. Some of our programs are face-to-face. Many are. That's the basis of our education. And others are online or are moving online, not with the goal of being fully online. That's not our model. But with the goal of using technology to enhance the educational opportunities for those students in the ways so that they can take advantage of our education given the constraints of whatever their lives happen to be.
Yeah, it's very good. I've seen it with my own children with programs that they're able to engage with fellow students and professors as well. So it's good that you're moving that way as well. We are wrapping up. So I appreciate everything you were saying about listening and hearing and asking curious questions, transparency, and engagement with the community. How would you like to end this tale we've told today?
Oh, you're asking me to sum it up, Lori, huh? I think that I appreciate coming to this program. This is talking about leaders in the Lehigh Valley, thinking about the Lehigh Valley and southeastern central Pennsylvania as a place, a great place to live, and our business and educational opportunities. There are multiple types of educational opportunities for all ages of students here in the Lehigh Valley, Albright College being one of those. We have so much to offer, from place to live, cost of living, opportunities for employment, and for us to be thinking about who the leaders are and how we bring, you know, more people to see, recognize the Lehigh Valley and southeastern central Pennsylvania as a really great place to live and work is I think something that I would put forward and say this is a great way to do it.
I really want to thank Dr. Jacqueline Fetro, president of Albright College, for being our guest this evening and for her willingness to share her lessons in leadership. Our best to her and all her endeavors as president of Albright College and as a lifelong leader. Thank you to Neil Heaver, our producer, and especially to our listeners. Be your best with purpose and passion, and you will be a leader. Have a lovely tomorrow.